darkness your eyes, penetrating and perfect truth, is seldom met with, even in 100,000 near-view compass. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself.
To the Buddha, we see the Dharma, we see the Sangha. Buddhism is a religion. This is not always understood. By people in the Western world who have grown up with a religion which has a somewhat different emphasis than the emphasis in Buddhism. It is more a matter of emphasis than it is a matter of difference in kind. In Western religions, the dominant emphasis tends to be that of an external or transcendent God who is separate from human beings, and some kind of bridge between the two has to be made. Now this is an emphasis that has not always been present in all areas of all parts of Western religions. There's a rich history of mysticism in Western religion that takes a somewhat different point of view, the point of view that is more a Buddhist point of view about this issue of the relationship between God and man. The Buddhist point of view is that there is not a deity separate from human beings, indeed from any being. Rather, all existence, all forms of existence, material, immaterial, seen and unseen, exists within the great Dharmakaya, literally body of truth, body of reality, and that just as all beings are part of the great Dharmakaya, so all beings possess the Buddha nature. In other words, the great Dharmakaya is the whole of us. Including all our spots and blemishes. We are not it, and we are of it. So the emphasis in Buddhist training is not on bridging a gap between a separate transcendent God and oneself. Rather, it is upon bringing our own life and all of its elements into alignment with what we truly are. Reverend Master used to say, not infrequently, look with the eyes of a Buddha and you will see the heart of a Buddha. You could also say, live in the way of a Buddha, and you will naturally and unself-consciously manifest the true life of Buddha. And all the forms of Buddhist training, and there are many forms and many schools, are all aimed to try to help us do this. To come into full alignment, to harmonize fully with what we already truly are. Our own true nature from which we can never be separated. To come into alignment with that. I am not God. There is nothing in me that is not of God. I am not the Buddha nature. There is nothing in me that is not of the Buddha nature. If this is the truth of things, then why would I wish to do that which creates the illusion for myself that something else is the case, that there is in fact a real separation between me and that great immaculacy. And this is the emphasis of the precepts. When they're properly understood. Not we undertake this training in the precepts so that we can turn a sinner into a saint. But we undertake this training in the precepts so a Buddha will not be confused about his or her own Buddhahood. So that we will not believe unrealities to be realities. so that we will not live judging ourselves and others and make this vast, magnificent, immaculate universe in our own mind and heart into something small and petty, just a mirror of our own self-centeredness and small-mindedness. When we truly meditate, we open our heart to what we truly are. We allow the superficial and the noisy, the stuff that's swirling around in our minds and our emotions, we allow that to quiet and take refuge in a deep stillness that we do not create, but that is just always there if we choose to go there. Now, it may be that at times that turbulence and that turmoil and that noise is so windswept and active that our meditation are more painful than anything else. And we experience spiritual aridity. Well, all such periods of being in a kind of spiritual desert, even though they can go on for a while, for some people for months or even years, they do one day come to an end if one keeps at it. Keeps at the training. Because reality was, is, and always will be the immense immaculacy, the immense voidness of self, the immense, unimaginable goodness of the Buddha nature. The true reality never was that which swarms around and drifts and runs around and sometimes somersaults around up at the surface. I'm talking about this because if one reads How to Grow a Lotus Blossom from the premise that Buddhism is not a religion, which tends to be a premise that's basically originating from a mistaken point of view about what religion essentially is, and certainly about what Buddhism is. But if one reads How to Grow a Lotus Blossom from that point of view, you end up with a very different take on what is happening, what is going on. You have a human being striving mightily, and then eventually coming to a kind of inexplicable relief from all that pain and darkness. And a well-earned tour through heaven, you might say. If you leave the eternal out of the picture, the Buddha nature out of the picture, you end up with a sadly two-dimensional and very often psychologized view of what is happening here. If you put the Buddha nature in the picture where the Buddha nature belongs, as that which is in charge of this whole process, you get a whole nother picture. And one that is immensely rich and vibrant and beautiful and awesome. I've been trying to point in various ways in this set of talks in the direction of this perspective on how to grow a lotus blossom. I've talked about being pulled from ahead as well as being shoved from behind. I've talked about the longing for the eternal, the longing for the Buddha nature, the longing love that rises up as a flame within one. I asked the question in yesterday's talk, well, what does eternal get out of someone doing a sangha? And while that isn't the most intelligent question anyone ever asked, it does at least make room for the eternal in this process. You don't get where Reverend Master went with this without a great surrender to the eternal. It is really that simple. When that happens, the process just takes off, and it's all you can do to keep up. Once the process is well and truly underway, you know you're not the one in charge. And you begin to see, and the further you go, the more you see, you never were the one in charge. The separate self is an illusion, not the reality. All things in this process are used by the eternal to help. All the karma that comes up to help us. Reverend Master discovered in a time of great need the principle that she then remembered for the rest of her life in her first months of training as a Zen monk. everything that happens is for my good. It's one thing to take that on faith, it's another thing to prove it true. To have it proven true in one's own experience, in great detail. The Eternal makes use of everything, and nothing is separate from itself. From this point of view, all the so-called evil is just the raw material of enlightenment, the potential for enlightenment. It is the clouds and that which has created the clouds that are in the clear sky. When our training is allowed to work upon that raw material, then its very Buddha nature can be revealed. It too shares in the immaculacy. Even the illusion of unworthiness, the illusion of uncleanness, shares in the immaculacy. There is nothing from the first. There is nothing unclean, unworthy from the first. There is just that which confuses and which saddens the heart and which needs help. In our very existence, can be a vehicle through which it gets the help it needs. And so you see in How to Grow the Lotus Blossom, How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, karma from this life and from previous lives, unscrolling, and as it unscrolls, the teaching unscrolls with it. This is not good to do because it results in these consequences. This is good to do because it results in these consequences. All that karmic pain and muck is the raw material of enlightenment. And out of it, out of its very heart, comes what is called a child of the Lord. manifestation, the realization of our own Buddha nature. Beginning not an ending. The point of the second half of How to Grow a Lotus Blossom is to be found above all in the teaching that is being given at a whole new level . It is true that while in the early months of this great retreat there was a great deal of suffering and a focus on getting to the cause of suffering. In the latter part of the retreat, there's a great deal of spiritual bliss and ecstasy. And hellish kinds of feelings and images were replaced with heavenly feelings and images. That's the scenery. And the scenery is all transitory. And like all transitory things, is to be treated with respect, but neither pushed away nor clung to. You can get yourself in as much trouble in heaven as you can get into in hell. And all you have to do is grasp after it and get swollen headed. You read How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, notice how our master does not do that. How that reverence and humility stays uppermost. How the training is really the same training as the scenery changes. And look at the teachings that are coming. Those teachings are not of much use to someone who's just at any moment going to conk out and be dead. Those teachings are for someone who's going to live longer and who has the potential to make clouds in a clear sky again, or to train away in a way that keeps the sky clear and that points the way for others to do the same. River Master lived for 20 years after 1976, dying in 1996. And she did her training every day and never rested on her laurels. A sinner did not become a saint through that retreat. A Buddha realized more deeply her Buddhahood. If she had died in 1976, I and a lot of other people would have been up the creek. The experience of enlightenment is not some kind of, and does not lead to some kind of static, blissful state. There is the awakening to one's true nature, which is a literal translation of the term kensho. And one has to train hard so as not to go back to sleep. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.